The Adventures of Henrietta Fine by Paul M. Levitt, narrated by Elizabeth Mansfield. Chapter 1. A sudden blow. With the great hospital fans beating like a flock of swans, and my father caught short by the bill, St. Barnabas Hospital told my mother and me they could no longer care for his cancer. It was the spring of 1922. Pop lay dying on a gray metal bed, amidst the smell of starched sheets, disinfectant, and bedpans, while outside the air, awash with spring, felt like the sweetness of baby's breath. Such strange death weather, I thought, and prayed that my father would be renewed by the season. Everything began to go wrong when I found a dead bird in the attic. That same day, as Pop was lying on the floor repairing the sewing machine, he was a first-rate mechanic. The wrench kept falling out of his hand. He couldn't grip it, and when he did, an electric pain shot from his hand to his shoulder. So he went to see a doctor. Two doctors, specialists, tons of them. For 2 years, while trying to learn what was wrong, the sore bones tortured him, extracting his teeth, putting his arm in traction, and removing his tonsils. But the numbness persisted. So they injected him with expensive serums extracted from horses, or was it apricots? Finally, when a growth began to appear on his neck, they tried to burn it with salves. And then, in a desperate attempt to stop what they'd finally diagnosed as a cancer, they operated without any success. The tumor in his neck was now the size of a grapefruit. He was choking to death. The nurses at St. Barnabas, all of them nuns, could see that Pop was a goner. So Mom, with her imperfect English, begged the hospital director to let him die there in peace. But the director wouldn't agree until Mom assured him that family and friends would pay all the bills. He insisted, however, that since the patient was dying, only adults would henceforth, his starchy word, be allowed in his room. At 16, I didn't qualify and was therefore to wait in the main lobby downstairs. When I explained that Mom needed me to translate what the nurses were saying, a nun patted me on the head and replied, "Henrietta, there's no need for further translation." But I had my own plan. Pop loved hearing me play the violin. Well, he was gonna have that chance, with or without the hospital director's permission. It was Pop, after all, who showed me the right positions for chords and arpeggios when my high school music teacher had taught me some screwball fingering. And it was Pop who always said that life without music wasn't worth living. An accomplished violinist, I was not. But I once played well enough in a city competition to win a free ticket to Carnegie Hall. Bolting from St. B, I hailed a cab, which was the way Pop liked to travel. Even though we once owned a Will St. Clair that had cost nearly $3,000, Pop liked to have someone else do the driving. As the cabbie wheeled down High Street, heading for South Orange Avenue, we passed a street hawker bellowing, "Bandanas, 25 cents a piece or three for a dollar." You'd be surprised at how many rubes fell for that line. And a street musician playing the violin while a little girl at his side sang, "Look for the silver lining." On South Orange Street, I counted the familiar streets whizzing by: Richmond, Norfolk, Newton, Bruce, Morris, Bergen, Camden, Fairmount, and silently wondered whether Mom could keep our beautiful house safe from the bank. The cab turned right on Littleton Avenue, passed under the canopy of overhanging trees, and pulled up to our red brick house at 117. The cabbie whistled, "Nice place." Surrounded by a black wrought iron fence and shaded by gnarled sycamores and ancient oaks, the house had gardens on every side, and large windows with striped canvas awnings perched us at the Bob's Summer Shop on Springfield Avenue. Telling the cabbie to wait, I darted to the side of the house and entered through the kitchen, which looked like a surgical operating room. It had white floor tiles, porcelain counters and icebox, and also stainless steel cabinets. A staircase ran from the kitchen to the attic, where I stored my most precious possessions, like a crystal radio set on which I listened to KDKA Pittsburgh and WGY Schenectady, and my violin. Even though I had my own bedroom and two goose down pillows, I much preferred to sleep in the attic. Finished in knotty pine, it housed my workbench and locksmithing tools, as well as all my sporting equipment. A dartboard, a mat for tumbling, dumbbells weighing 5, 10, and 20 pounds, a crossbar for chinning, a punching bag. Pop and I often went to the fights at the armory in the Bank Street Arena, and a pool table we bought secondhand. I was pretty good with a cue stick, a lot better than some of the plug uglies down at the local pool hall. Grabbing my violin and the case, I remembered leaving my music on the living room piano, where just a few days before, a friend and I had been playing duets. Charging down the stairs, I spotted the Iceman with his horse and wagon. He was standing in the rutted alley behind the house, lifting huge cakes of ice onto his burlap-covered shoulder. I opened the door to let him in and dashed off to the living room. 20 feet high and 40 feet long, with wood-beam ceilings decoratively painted in gold, and walls covered with red and green tapestries of forest scenes, the living room looked like a harem in a silent movie. Finding my music on top of the upright Kroger piano, I bounded out the front door and back into the taxi. Only now did I notice that hanging from the rearview mirror on a leather string was not only a crucifix, but also a small metal casting of a large man supporting a midget on his shoulders. The cabbie said the curio came from Sicily, the cathedral of Monreale, and signified that we stand on the shoulders of those generations and giants who labored before us. Upon reaching St. B, I tried going through the lobby, but as I no longer had a pass from the desk, the cop on the beat blocked my path. Retreating to the rear of the hospital, I saw a laundry truck unloading towels and sheets. Two colored guys were checking the delivery against the invoice, and the loading dock cop, a sweating, red-faced blimp, was cleaning his nails with a penknife. Bold as brass, I climbed the steps to the dock and told the cop that I was a midget with the heebie-jeebie vaudeville group and that I was expected upstairs to entertain one of the patients, a Mr. Saul Fine in room 314. The cop put away the knife, looked me over, and said, "Prove it." Luckily for me, Mom's cousin, Ed Lowry, a vaudeville dancer and comedian, had taught me tons of routines, and Pop had often taken me to Keith's Palace and Lois State to see all the famous performers. What pleased me as much as the shows were the cylindrical candy machines on the backs of the seats called Eatmores. You'd put a nickel in the side, turn a handle, and a purple roll of chocolate would appear. The only hitch came when the nickel got stuck and you'd have to bang on the machine, upsetting the person in front. Anyway, I asked the cop to hold my violin while I did my brief skit. "A guy and a gal are out walking. Got it?" "Right," said the cop, nodding his head. She says, "Eddie, Eddie, do you love me?" He says, "I'll say." "Do you think I'm beautiful?" "Uh-huh." "Are my eyes the loveliest you've ever seen?" "Yep." "My mouth like a rosebud?" "Sure." "And my figure divine?"
"You bet."
"Oh, Eddie, you say the nicest things. Tell me some more." Long pause. The cop stared at me blankly, took out a large red handkerchief and wiped his sweating face.
"Well?"
he asked.
"Well, what? What's the point?"
"Here," I said, "hand me the violin." Taking the violin, I played Danny Boy, which brought tears to his eyes.
"Now that I can understand," he said. "You're going to be late if you stand here chewing the fat, so get on upstairs."
With a wave and a thanks, I made a beeline for the third floor. When I reached the nurse's desk, a nun stopped me, fortunately not one that I knew. Holding up my violin case, I said that I was delivering a singing telegram and marched straight past her into room 314. Pop couldn't raise his head. The tumor looked grotesque, as if a coconut was attached to his neck. On one side of his bed was Mom, and on the other, Charles Courtney, a family friend and locksmith par excellence. Until that point in my life, I'd met only two famous people, Babe Ruth and Charles Courtney. The Babe stayed overnight once at our house on Littleton Avenue. The Yankees had played an exhibition game against the Newark Bears. The Babe, having drunk too much beer during the game, was afraid to board the bus to New York and face the manager, Miller Huggins. So the Babe asked a friend to suggest a hotel. The friend led him to Pop, who insisted that the Babe stay with us. That evening was something special, as the Babe entertained us with stories and jokes. Before he left, he put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Remember, always take a full swing." To this day, I'm not sure whether he meant swing or swig, but he sure was a swell guy. Charles Courtney was another prince. Pop met him in New York, really because of me. At my attic workbench, I was always taking apart locks and filing keys to make them fit different tumblers. Having read about Mr. Courtney, Pop asked if I'd like to meet him. So one day in New York, we paid our nickel and hopped on the L, which led us out just a few feet from his door on 125th Street west of Harlem. Hanging in the shop was a model airplane about 3 feet long, made entirely of keys and parts of locks welded together. It was really terrific. From that day forth, Pop and Mr. Courtney became friends. When Mr. C, as the family called him, would come to Newark to see the Bears play, he always slept at our house. I loved those visits, because he never failed to show me some tricks of the locksmithing trade. Now, here he was, with his thick mustache and lined face, sitting next to Pop's bed. Mom, knowing I'd been banned from the room, kept muttering in Yiddish that the police would arrest me. Assuring her that I had nothing to worry about, I took out the violin, pushed a chair to the foot of Pop's bed, climbed up, and played him a passage from one of his favorites, the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto. Tears streamed down his face. Mom and Mr. C looked blubbery too. Pop, who had a terrible time talking, rasped that he'd like to see me alone. So Mom and Mr. C went into the hall. I sat down on the side of Pop's bed and took one of his hands. He smiled, and with a tremendous effort, spoke briefly.
"You called, Siegel?"
"Don't talk, Pop."
"It's important."
"He'd be glad to hire Susie at $5 a week more."
"Murray Hardwin?"
"He'll take all the fabrics. Harry Panzer all the machinery." Sadly, I was lying. Everything had been looted, but I wasn't going to tell Pop that.
"Money?"
"We're rolling in dough, Pop." He started to cry. I suppose his thinking that Mom and I would be in good shape made him happy. A good reason, I guess, for occasionally telling a whopper. He wiped his eyes and took my hand again.
"Outside. The spring, it's like Poland when I was a child.
What do you remember most about Poland? I asked, trying to keep his thoughts from straying to business.
The cold and the singing. In America, for some reason, there is no singing.
The wild laurel's almost in bloom. Your favorite?
The hikes. Remember, the two of us swatting mosquitoes.
Just as soon as you're better, we'll do it again.
Ah, I wish for 20 years more.
You're getting better, Pop. We'll get a new doctor.
No.
He let my hand fall from his.
Finish high school.
I'll try, Pop.
For my sake.
I sat there feeling I couldn't say no, and wishing I were a boy able to strike out on my own. My feelings tell me one thing and my head something else. This statement seemed for a sec to energize Pop, who spoke with more animation than he had for some time.
Feelings, they lead to all sorts of crimes. Study, learn, trust your head.
I wiped the sweat from his forehead.
Not that again, Pop.
Education opens doors.
For some.
America is,
yeah, I know, money and jobs.
Opportunity, yes. But also an experiment. It substitutes freedom for conformity and points to the future, but without a path.
I can learn on my own.
College. It's not like high school.
Thank goodness for that. His breath grew shorter.
If you quit.
Mr. C offered to take me the first lady locksmith in New York.
Industry, pluck.
Sure, Pop. He paused, lost in memories.
A favor, Henrietta.
I was almost certain he'd ask me once again to remain in school.
You have my permission. To think me overbearing, even unfair, if in the years to come, you remember me also with love.
I fell across his bed and wept. 2 days later, he died. I remembered then what my friend Marty Lippman had said when his father died. The word he used wasn't died, but lost. At the time, I thought it strange. Now, I understood. When a person dies, he is lost to us. Absent. Gone. It sounded so easy, but the fact that my father would never again be there for me, never to answer a question, or tell me how it was in the old country, overwhelmed me. In the cemetery, standing in the uncut grass among the chaotic shrubbery, I could smell the wild laurel as we lowered him into the ground. A rabbi spoke, but I heard nothing except the grating of the shovel and the dirt hitting Pop's coffin.